All right. We'll pick it up with Jephthah. And for those of you who weren't here last week, we discovered that Jephthah had sort of a bad beginning, didn't he? The Bible tells us he was the son of a prostitute. And so he had an immoral father and immoral mother. And as a result of that, he was somewhat of an outcast. We're not told about his early years, how he was treated, but we are told that after at a particular time, his brothers came to him and cast him out, told him he couldn't have an inheritance within his father's house because he was the son of another woman. Now, I read that, and I don't get the impression that that was the first time they mistreated him. That they, you know, through all the years, they treated him just fine, like a brother, and all of a sudden, probably at that time, as I said last week, his father, Gilead, had died. And it's hard to believe that they just immediately turned against him. It probably, they didn't accept him from the very beginning. And so he had that kind of rough childhood. That would be tough growing up in that kind of an environment. And then he's driven out to the land of Tob, and he gets together with worthless men, and they go out. And really, that's all the Bible says, that they went out. At least the ESV. I think I don't know of any translation that says much more than that. There's people that will add to that, you know, the idea that, well, it's kind of assumed that they went out on raids or they went out plundering. I think I told you last week, I don't know everything that he was involved in at that time. He clearly was a rough individual and because of his background. And a lot of people would say that he was on the thuggish side. And, well, you know, there no doubt he was harsh. But he was a natural leader of men. So he has these worthless men that kind of gravitate toward him, and he becomes their leader. And they really become a great fighting crew of men. And it reminds us, you remember in the Old Testament, David, of course, he himself, you remember when he was on the run from Saul, he gathered together 400 men, and they then become, they're called over and over mighty men, the mighty men of David then, 400 of them. And their background was, you'd pretty much call them worthless. They were men who were rejected themselves, men who were in debt, men who were just having problems. But David gathered them together and turned them into a great army, his mighty men. He had great forces, of course, but these 300 men that were kind of worthless became his mighty men, his main fighters around him. And so you picture that and you think that's sort of what has happened with Jephthah. But you have to be a great leader to lead men, any men. You have to have some real skill in the area of leadership. And when it comes to men who are also rejects and cast off and are rough and tough themselves and described as worthless, they're not just going to let anyone lead them. Like, you can't just walk in there and say, hey, I'm going to be your leader. You have to have some real ability. And so obviously he does, to the point where he gains this reputation of being a mighty man of war, a mighty warrior, the ESV says, man of valor, some translations say. And so he was marked by bravery is what the word mighty points to. And he was strong and courageous, and that's who he was. Now, in verse 4, then, we find it says, and after a time, the Ammonites made war against Israel. And I think I tied that in last week. I don't know if I did Can't recall if I did, but I should have. But that ties back into chapter 10 at verse 17. The Ammonites were called to arms and they encamped in Gilead. And verse 4 kind of ties back to that. Everything else from verse 18 down to that point, just background, just giving us some background on Jephthah. And so, but this is the time that, again, the Ammonites, they have been attacking the Israelites for 18 years, and now they're at it again. And so they gather themselves together. And so now the Israelites are, again, they gather themselves, but they don't really have a leader. And so they at verse 18, again, of chapter 10, and the people, the leaders of Gilead said one to another, "Who is the man who will begin to fight the Ammonites?" Now, this is a little bit different. I didn't point this out last week, but this is a little bit different. Most of the judges were identified as men who God raised up. And I'm not saying Jephthah wasn't that, but he wasn't directly called by God. Like you remember with Gideon, who came to Gideon? The angel did. And that was often the case. This is really the people's idea. They're just thinking, now we're about to be attacked again. But you know, there's a castaway. There's someone we cast out, or at least we allowed to be cast out. And he's become a mighty warrior. And which tells us he's gained a lot of victories. He's obviously, you don't become a mighty warrior just for nothing. He has won victories. Whatever his role was in the land of Tob and the things that he did, he probably, I said last week again, if you weren't here, that I don't like the idea myself. Some people take this position that, again, he went out on raids and plundering and things, but that's always a murderous kind of situation. Where, again, criminals would go in and overtake a village and kill women, men, women, and children and take their stuff. And that's how they survived. I can't imagine that that was Jephthah. The rest of the narrative really doesn't support him being that kind of individual. But again, the Bible just says he went out. So a lot of people believe that he was kind of like a mercenary, and that some of these villages that would be under attack by some, probably Ammonites coming once in a while and just plundering them, that he was brought in his band of these worthless men, and they would be more like protectors. And he gained a reputation, victory after victory, you know, pushing back the Ammonites, and he was a mighty man or a mighty warrior from that standpoint. Well, now they're about to attack on a large scale basis again. And we learned from the situation with Gideon that that's just how these people operated. It wouldn't just be a constant war. They would gather and then go and attack them and everything. And then they go back, and then another season come back, and now it's about to happen again. And they think, what about that man that has been cast away? You know, we've been hearing he's a mighty warrior. Let's go get Jephthah. Let's bring him back and let him fight for us. And so that's what they do. And so we see they call him, and you remember at first he kind of questions them, like, you know, really, you allowed them to cast me out. You didn't do anything to prevent it, and now you want my help? And they promise to make him head. And so he agrees that that's what he's going to do, that he would fight for them, and then he would become the head of Israel at that time. And you just think how ironic that is, that the one who was cast away, the one who was a reject, now all of a sudden he's going to become the leader of all of these people, including his brothers, who really are the ones who cast him out. The elders just allowed it. But so now everything's in place. And while God didn't directly call him, certainly providentially God is involved. And later on, we'll find that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him and all of that. God gave him the victory. There's no doubt about that. But he does something now that's unpredictable. Like when you think of someone like this who had this kind of background, raised in a rough place after he was cast away and a great fighter and all of this, you know, you think he's going to go and attack those Ammonites right away and gain victories and we're going to be good. He doesn't do that because Jephthah's smart. And as I said earlier, you have to have something to be the leader of the kind of men he was the leader of. You can't be stupid. You know, you gotta have some smarts about you, and he did. And he demonstrates it here because he doesn't just rush in and fight against the Ammonites. Like, who wants war, really? I mean, is war a good thing? No. Is it sometimes necessary? Yes. But even necessary wars are devastating, that they're always destructive. You're always talking about lives that are lost. You're always talking about homes that are destroyed, fathers that are killed, and so on. But war is never good. It may be a good reason behind it, and it might be necessary, but it's always devastating. Who wants to go to war? Jephthah is a warrior, and he's a mighty one. But he doesn't just rush in there. Instead, he uses diplomacy. So he sends messengers to the king of the Ammonites and says, what's going on? Why are you fighting against me? What are you doing? Well, he sends messengers right back. And he said, I'll tell you exactly why. It's because you all came out of Egypt and stole our land. And all the way from the river of Arnon to Jabbok and even to the Jordan, all of that, that's ours. And all of that land, you're talking about, if you you remember on the east side of the Jordan is where the tribes of Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they all dwelled on that side. That really wasn't what God wanted, but that's what they wanted, and God agreed to it. And so they're over there, and Ammon is just east of that. And that's why that was the main portion, the main place where they were attacking for 18 years. And then it spilled over, you remember, to Benjamin and Judah and so forth on the other side of the river. But that was the main place of attack. And now the king of the Ammonites come along and say, all that territory, you stole it from us. Give it back peacefully. We'll be good. Everything will be all right. And Jephthah says, listen, Mr. King, you have to check your history because that's not accurate. And it's really amazing when you think about Jephthah that he has the knowledge that he does. Like, I don't know what, maybe when he was growing up and his brothers wouldn't play with him or any, or, you know, all of that, he didn't have anything to do but study the scriptures and stuff, whatever. But he knew the history in great detail. He knew the history of the people of Israel. Pretty impressive, actually. So he says to this king, you need to check your history. We didn't steal your land. We after we left Egypt, we went through the wilderness, came to the Red Sea, and finally up into Kadesh, and that's where we remained. And we sent word to the Edomites, can we pass through your land? And you remember they said, no, we're, you know, they hated Israel. They're kind of cousins for whatever, but they hated Israel. So, no, they wouldn't. So he said, all right. So we sent word to the king of Moab, and he wouldn't let us go through either. So we just stayed there at Kadesh. Now, you can go back and read Numbers and the different places. All of that is exactly what happened according to the scriptures. It's all in the Pentateuch. And so he said, we stayed. Finally, after a while, he said, we went on around Edom and around Moab. We never violated any territorial laws or anything like that. Never went into your territory. Ended up on the east side of Moab and on the other side of the Arnon River. And there, that's where they camped. Then they sent word to the Amorites, to their king, Sihon. And wanted to pass through there. And again, they didn't let him. But not only did they not let him, the king didn't trust the Israelites. And so he attacked them. But God gave them the victory. And so they ended up overcoming the Amorites and taking all that land on that east side of the river that I was talking about. All of that now, you look on any map, you can just Google the tribes of Israel, whatever, you'll see all of that. That Gilead is right there and all of that. And that's the land under consideration. And Jephthah in detail is telling this king, you need to go, but you have some revisionist history on your mind. We didn't steal anything. This land belonged to the Amorites, not the Ammonites. And we didn't even attack them. They attacked us. God gave us the victory. And so now that's our land. And by the way, while you're checking your history, you ought to check your theology as well. Because it was God who gave us the land, he tells them. Our God gave us the land. What are you going to do with the land that your God gave you? Chemosh was their God. What are you going to do? And he just... You know, being diplomatic. He didn't believe in their God or anything, but he just asked, what are you doing with the land your God gave you? You going to give that land up? Of course not. They would say, no, our God gave us this land. Again, that's just a little east of the land we're talking about. They said, no, our God gave us that land. Well, our God gave us this land. Should we give it up? You're not giving up the land your God gave you. We shouldn't give up the land our God gave us. He's the one who dispossessed the people, the Amorites, and gave us the land. And by the way, you ought to check out your chronology as well. Because we've been in this land for 300 years. Like, why are you doing this now? Why are you making a big deal about all of this now? Why didn't you do it years before? 300 years we've been here. This is our land. We haven't sinned in any way. And so all of that, you know, that's a far cry. Him operating and sending word like that, you don't usually associate that sort of thing with a mighty warrior. But he's smart. He's skillful. He's a leader. You start to understand how he could, even in the beginning, get all of those men to follow him. He knows what he's doing. But even when you know what you're doing, and you try to be as diplomatic as you can be, it doesn't always work. Does diplomacy always work? It'd be great if it did. And we could do away with all wars. And every time nations rise against each other, they just talk it out. And all right, we're good. That'd be great. But we know life doesn't work like that. And it doesn't work like that for Jephthah. The king of Ammon simply didn't listen. He wants what he wants. He feels like they've been fighting against Israel and really terrorizing them for 18 years. They have, they believe, the upper hand. And so now no, we're not giving it. Give us our land and we'll be good. But other than that, there's going to be a war. And so we realize then that is the way it's going to be. So you drop down. At verse 29 is where it says, and then the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah. And he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and he passed on to Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah of Gilead, he passed on to the Ammonites. And then verse 30, and Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Now, we'll get back to that vow here in just a few minutes. I'm not going to go in great detail about it, but the only thing I'll say right now is this was an unwise vow for him to make. And even people who are very smart and skillful, you know, they do things that aren't very smart. And really, again, we don't know the complete background of Jephthah. His mother is a prostitute. Most believe that she would have been a Canaanite. And I read one place where she would probably be a Syrian. I don't why. I'm not quite sure what that's about. But she, it's almost certain that she wasn't an Israelite. And so he may have had, and the whole region there, the Jews, all the Israelites have been heavily influenced by false gods, haven't they? That's why they're in this mess. Because they've turned away from God and started serving other gods. And so he's acting kind of like a Canaanite here. Because this is what Canaanites and Ammonites and Amorites, this is what all of these pagans would do before they would go to war. They'd offer a sacrifice to their gods. And, you know, that's how they operated. And so now before he goes to war, he makes a vow. Didn't offer sacrifice, but he makes a vow to God. And it was totally unnecessary. He didn't have to do that. He was going to gain the victory anyway. But he makes a vow, and it's a vow that he would come to regret, of course, as most of you know. But he makes this vow, and he does it hastily. If we really, the best and most practical teaching from the story of Jephthah, it has to do with vows. And one point is just be careful about vows you make. Don't make them in haste. Don't make them without thinking. You get yourself in all kinds of trouble. You remember in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, and at verse 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 at verse 1 says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen, is better than to the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. But then verse 2, be not rash with your mouth. That's always good advice, isn't it? And whether you're talking about vow making or whatever, just don't be rash with your mouth. Nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Now, we'll see. I'll come back to this passage a little bit later. But we'll see that he's basically there talking about the business of vow making. Be careful. Don't be rash. And now we're talking about when you make promises to God. And we all do. We all have. And when you do, when you in prayer, you're making any kind of promise to God, you better have thought that thing through and you better be prepared to fulfill that vow that you're making, because God takes them seriously. But here is Jephthah, and he's not thinking this thing through. The whole vow itself is nonsensical, really. When you stop and think about what he vowed, whatever comes out from the doors of my house, really? You don't have any idea what that might be. You don't know if it's going to be a family member, it's going to be an animal, it could be a child from a neighbor, a stranger, it could be any. He doesn't know. It's just an open vow. Whatever comes out of the doors of my house. He says that he's going to offer it up for a burnt offering. You think he really thought that thing through? No, he's just emotional and wants this victory and believes that God can help him. Now, that's a good thing, and he's right about that. But as I said earlier, he didn't need to bargain with God for that. He already has the Spirit of the Lord, and God's going to give him the victory. And this vow made in haste is going to be regretted. And so we'll see that in just a minute. But as we read on, it says, of course, the Jephthah crossed over the Ammonites to fight against them. And the Lord gave them into his hand. And he struck them from Aroer to the neighborhood of Minnith, 20 cities as far as Abel Kerumim. And with a great blow. So the Ammonites were subdued before the people. So we read rather quickly that God gave him the victory. And so they are no longer then going to be abused by the Ammonites. God has clearly raised him up to be the deliverer like he has all the other judges. A little bit different circumstance, but God is behind it. So, verse 34, then Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dances. She was his only child. Beside her, he had neither son nor daughter. And as soon as he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you have become the cause of great trouble to me, for I have opened my mouth to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow." Now, that's very impressive. And again, the greatest lessons we can learn here from Jephthah is this idea of vow making. And that's what I want to talk to you about the most, a little bit of time we have left. But of course, the thing that is greatly debated in this passage that makes it such a troubling passage is this offering up of his daughter. And was it a literal human sacrifice, or was it Jephthah dedicating his daughter to temple service? And those are the two options. And you want to know the truth about it? If you ask me, it depends on what day of the week it is. God, I can go back and forth with that. When you read the text itself, the literal words itself would lead you to believe that he was going to offer his daughter up as a sacrifice, as a burnt offering. And almost all commentaries for several centuries of the early centuries, I can't remember, it's like up to the 9th century or so, they all interpreted the same way. He was going to offer her up as a sacrifice. But then, while it may sound like that at first, the facts don't all add up with regard to that. And so most scholars today and later scholars believe, because of how it's worded and everything, that he was offering over to temple service. And there's really quite a few arguments that they have with regard to that. Regardless of what was on his mind. Now, one thing we know from, remember the all of that when he was dealing with the king of the Ammonites? How did he know all of that stuff? All of that stuff was in the Word of God. He was really preaching to the king. It was all, like I said, you go back to Numbers, that's where the history is. Exodus, the history is would tell you, oh, he was right on with all of that stuff. And so he knew, the point of it is, he knew God's law. What kind of life and what he did with it, I don't know. He was a rough guy, all of that. But he knew God's law. So he certainly knew that God would be opposed to a human sacrifice. That would be an abomination to God. But even more than that, he would know that really, he would never have to sacrifice his daughter. Whether he did or not, that's still up to debate. And again, a lot of people think that he did. He fulfilled this vow. But the law made provision for that. You get a chance, read some of, I think it's Leviticus 27, maybe. But you go back and you'll find there were different things you could do in a situation like this. First of all, it was the job of the Israelites. The firstborn was always given to the Lord. But it wouldn't be a sacrifice would be made, but it wouldn't be a human sacrifice. It would be a sacrifice. That daughter or that son of yours would be redeemed by a lamb. And that was a law. And there was a law within the law of Moses that if you had a vow that was connected with a person, you could exchange that. Instead of the person, you could give, I think it was for, it's different for men and women, and that's just the way it was. But I think it's like for a man, 50 shekels of I can't remember, it was silver, I guess, whatever it was, 50 shekels for a woman, 30 shekels. But the point of it is this. There were provisions made in the law that even if he was thinking, whatever comes out of my door, and it was his daughter, he would never have to really go through with that. And so, now, that didn't mean he didn't. Because of his background and who he is, and we don't know. And a lot of scholars think he actually did that. But then when you read the rest of this text, it really doesn't sound like it. It says, and she said to him, my father, you have opened your mouth to the Lord. Do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth. Now, the Lord has avenged you on your enemies, on the Ammonites. So she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Leave me alone 2 months that I may go up and down on the mountains and weep for my virginity and I and my companions. And, you know, most who take the position that she was just being dedicated to the temple, which there's passages that you can go to. Exodus chapter 38, verse 8 is one. 1 Samuel 2, verse 22 is another. If you just want to read about women who were given to the Lord to serve in the temple. It was a big thing. It was a big deal. Like, if that's what Jephthah did, don't take that lightly. She was what? His only child. If he did that, that would mean he would have no legacy. He would have no children. His line would die with him. That was a big deal. In Western culture, in our culture, that may not be that big of a deal. It was huge to them. It was huge for a woman to be a perpetual virgin. What is it that the Jews and particularly Jewish women, that what was the absolute best thing that could ever happen to you? You could have children. I hear some say, right. It was just a terrible thing if you were barren. But a part of that was even elevated was they all wanted to be the one who through whom the Messiah would come. If you're a perpetual virgin, what's the chances of that happening? Of course, we know how it really happened in the end, but they didn't know that. And so the point of it is, it was a terrible sacrifice for her, and it's no fault of her own, to never marry, never have children, never have a family. That wasn't something that women really wanted. And so that would have been harsh, even if it wasn't a literal sacrifice of her life. That was a very harsh situation. And so she goes out and what? She mourns what? Her life? No, her virginity. And it seems to me that the thing you'd be worried about most at that stage, like you're about to die, so what, I mean, are you really going to mourn that you didn't have a family at that point? Or would you be more likely to mourn the fact that you're about to die? So, again, all of that, none of that is conclusive at all. But just saying, as you read this text, it does appear, even it says, and at the end of the 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he made. And she had never known a man. And it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went year by year to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gibeonite, 4 days in the year. And I read where the word lament there, and I didn't look up translations. I really should have, but the Hebrew word points more to a celebration than a mourning. And so that might tell you a little something. And then there's one more thing. You see down at verse 30, where it says, and Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Now, if I was ever going to hang my hat on something that says this was, he was literally going to have to offer her daughter, if she came out of that door, that daughter as a literal burnt offering. If I was ever going to hang my hat on a verse, it'd be that verse. But here's the problem. Scholars, Hebrew scholars, who know this far more than I, will tell you a couple of things about that verse. Number one, the word and there can and often is translated or instead of and. And that's not a made up thing. I checked it out. And because sometimes I read things from commentaries and they make a case on something like that. And then when I go and do the research, I find out I can't see that. None of the sources I turn to say that. But this, it did. That word is often translated or. And when you look at verse 30 and when it says, verse 31, when it says that, let's see, and whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's. And then it says, I will offer it. Now, the word it in the ESV, maybe some of your translations, I have a footnote. It has a two there. I look down here and it says, or him. So that word it could be translated him. And if that were the case, it would, if all of that was true, it would read something like this. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, or I will offer him a burnt offering. A lot of scholars believe that's exactly how it should be read. And so the situation would be an either or. If an animal comes out, I'm going to offer it up for a burnt offering. If whatever a person comes out, which he really expected a person to come out, because whoever is masculine, so he masculine, he expected a person. If it's a person, then I'll give the person to the Lord. Now, there's problems with that too. Like what if it was a servant of his, not an Israelite? How's that person going to serve at the temple? You know, so, you know, no matter what, that's why people have debated this thing for years and years and years, and it will always be debated. Because either way, I mean, it can go either way with this. But there's some good reasons why that you might conclude that he didn't really actually offer up his daughter as a burnt offering, but dedicated her to the temple. You take that position, I wouldn't be mad at you. Take the other position, I wouldn't be mad at you. But the most important thing is, what do we learn about vows? Because whatever you say about Jephthah, it was impressive that he was willing to make a vow. So we'll talk about that a little bit and then probably start getting into Samson here in the next week or so.